Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Sunday, March 20th, 2011. I'm Sam Minter. I've got Yvonne Bo with me. Hello.
Hello.
Anyway, we've got a fairly news-packed week going on, of course, with Libya and a bunch of other stuff going on. I'm going to start out with something real quick and lighter, I guess, that's a follow-up from something we talked about a couple weeks ago. A couple weeks ago, Yvonne kicked off the show with a story about the country's happiest person, where a statistical abstract had been done, found, like, you know, all the things that are most likely to be happy, and then they went out and found
someone. The person
someone
was Chinese, American, kosher Hebrew, lived in Hawaii, was over 65 years old, made for over $125,000 a year, and, gosh, I don't know how the hell I memorized all of these, and owned his own business, okay?
Yes.
And was married. Okay. Yeah. So those were the biggest traits. I think I covered them all.
So apparently, you know,
so they found a guy in Hawaii matched the profile.
They found a guy in Hawaii who matched that profile. And anyway, so this brought up the question. You know, this I guess was posted. Where was the article? It was in the New York Times. Anyway,
it was in the New York Times.
Anyway, so apparently a lot of readers, you know, asked. I guess the reporter who put this together was Catherine.
What would be
Ramsey.
The opposite?
And yes, what would be the opposite? What would be the least happy person?
The most miserable fucking human in the United States.
So now I don't think they went through the process of actually finding this person. However, according to their profile, statistically speaking, the least happy American would be a 4'10" middle-aged Muslim woman without children who is separated from her husband and earns under $12,000 a year. She is also an unemployed manufacturing worker in West Virginia.
Oh, like, my God. I mean, I forgot about the height thing, you know, because that guy was also tall. I mean, you know, talk about... Gosh, that sounds so terrible.
Yes, so, you know, like I said, I don't think they went out and actually tried to find this person, but, you know.
And God only knows if this person exists with this demographic profile. I kind of have the feeling that they probably don't.
Well, you know, I would say that, but to be honest, reading the profile of that other guy, I wouldn't have thought he existed either.
Well, the one thing is that that's true. I mean, that was a tough one.
Yeah, Chinese American, kosher Jew, living in Hawaii, owning his own business. I mean, yeah, not all of those things are unrealistic, but altogether, it's like there can't be that many people who meet that. You know,
That's right. Correct. Well, but these sound. I mean, especially having unemployed, manufacturing, divorced. I mean, separated Muslim women. Okay, earning less than $12,000 a year in West Virginia. Who used to work in manufacturing? That sounds like a tougher stretch.
You know,
I will say that.
But maybe she might be out there.
Maybe she might be out there. She might be out there. Yes, she may be out there. But you know, who knows?
And if she is, so anyway, you know, I feel sorry for her.
I feel sorry for her too. My God, jeez, my Lord, talk about the most unlucky streak in America. My God.
Okay. So, look, the actual agenda for today, you know, is going to be, you know, we're going to talk about Libya. We're probably going to touch on a few of the other countries where there's stuff going on. There's some updates on Japan, and we'll probably try to get into the New York Times paywall. There's a bunch of other stuff I had on my potential list for this week, but then Libya happened, and, you know, boom. So, Yvonne, you were saying.
I was going to say that one thing that, you know, our show, we've been doing this now, it'll be this summer, how many years? Five?
Let me check. And actually, I meant to check on one other thing just to check, but keep talking.
Okay, it'll be quite a long time. I will say that over the first couple of years, we had, I had to do this show from quite a lot of different locales around the Americas, but the last year and a half, I haven't been traveling much because I decided to change jobs. I gotta say one thing I'm realizing. I really like to travel.
You miss it?
Get another job. Yeah, it started to get to a point where I'm just like, oh, God. I'm like, I don't travel anymore? I mean, really? I'm like, you know, no. I gotta get me another job that travels. This is just, you know, this just is not... I ain't meant to stay on the ground this long.
So,
I mean, you know me for I don't know how many years. Even when I was in college, I was always traveling around like a freaking... I mean, you know, for college students.
From prior experience, I have decided I do not like traveling for work. However, I do like traveling, and I haven't done much of it in the last few years. And I wouldn't mind getting, you know, into a position where I could do such a little more often. And I don't mean work position. I just mean, like, with the family, with the money, with everything else, where I felt like I could really, like, go take a week and do something interesting. But, you know, we'll probably wait for the kid to get a little older. We'll see. You know, and we might do some short-term things. Like, we were talking about just, like, sometime next week, actually. Like, both my wife and daughter are on spring break next week, so we might do an overnight trip somewhere. Not like a long trip,
awesome.
But you know, we might do an overnight drive somewhere that we haven't been before.
That sounds like a cool
idea.
Sounds like a cool idea. I like it. Okay.
Just,
all right.
So. I just want to make one note on the length of time of the show since you brought this up, because you can help remember next week. One, our very first show was June 3rd, 2007. So 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. So we're coming up on 4 years. It'll be 4 years in June. And also, more impressively, this show that we are recording right now is show number 199. So so next week will be our 200th show.
Wow. Now that's a milestone.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
shoot.
So we'll see if we actually remember next week, but you know, to say
anything. And I will say that we have noticed that, I don't know how many people are terminally listening to the podcast, but there certainly our number of uploads over a number of years is up.
Yeah. We'll see. And yeah, I'm a bit behind on doing my stats and I got too far behind. So I lost 2 weeks at the end of December and I'm really bummed about that. I have no idea how many people listened those 2 weeks. So I'm distraught and upset about that. But anyway, let's move on and talk about Libya.
Libya, baby. All right. Okay. I know that you are very, very hyped up about the whole Libya thing. So I'm going to let you go ahead and discharge.
Let me start on Libya. Okay, here's the thing. I mean, Yvonne and I, for the last few shows, we've talked about, like, are we really thinking about doing this? Are we really thinking about doing this? Are you crazy? Why are people, you know, and look, yeah, the fundamental thing being that whether or not we think it's a good idea for Gaddafi to get out of there, whether or not we have any sympathy for the rebels in Libya, which frankly, we don't really know all that much about, but whether or not we sympathize with them and whether or not it might be a good idea for Gaddafi to go and for them to take over or whatever, there's another question of, well, how involved should we be? You know, what should be, you know, that involvement? And for the longest time, the Obama administration seemed to be somewhat standing back. And, you know, there were public statements coming out from Secretary of Defense Gates and such that it would be a bad idea to go into another country. I mean, he didn't specifically call out Libya, but he was making the general point. And, you know, there seemed to be some reluctance to jump into this mess. And then, you know, sort of the Arab League and the Europeans started getting more and more excited about this and started actually taking somewhat of the lead in pushing for, you know, a UN resolution calling for various actions. And the U.S., sometime in this last week, sort of flipped their opinion and said, okay, we'll support this. And so that resolution passed, last week sometime. I forget what day.
Well, I don't know. Here's the one thing. I don't know if they were ever against it.
They were leading the charge for it. We were never threatening a veto or anything, but we certainly weren't expressing a lot of enthusiasm. Let's put it that way. It wasn't just that we weren't taking the lead. It was that we were like, really? You know, and I think the administration was doing that as well. But then at some point, it's like, okay, here we go. The resolution was passed. And then a couple days later, the action started. And yesterday, Saturday, as we record this, things started off with the French doing some military actions. And a lot of people had been talking about prior to this weekend that, hey, wait a second, this might be a situation where the U.S. is actually letting everybody else take the lead. They're going to do all the work, and we'll just sit back and say, okay, good luck, guys. And with the French starting out, it looked like that might be the case. But then starting with a few hours later, we started tossing cruise missiles into Libya, and there have been various other things we've been doing since. Now, I will say right up front that, you know, the balance of our engagement versus other countries seems to be a lot more balanced than, you know, a lot of the other engagements one can point to. The previous two, Gulf Wars, Kosovo, whatever, all of these other things.
I saw a list of countries that sent warplanes, like Canada, Italy, France, Norway, Denmark, the British. It was a pretty extensive list of other countries that definitely had put their air power in, you know,
yes,
into the situation.
And so this clearly is not a situation where, you know, it's a coalition in name only and it's really the Americans.
Right.
But our involvement is still a significant involvement.
Yes.
You know, as Hillary Clinton put it in her her press conference the other day, yesterday, I guess, there are unique capabilities that the U.S. has that no one else has, and they're bringing them to bear.
I'll give an example. Slap me around, will you? Okay. I'll give an example. Okay. They just mentioned that apparently B-2 stealth bombers had crossed in and struck a couple of significant targets in Libya, and let's face it, nobody else has that stuff.
Now, there are a couple, you know, additional things that I'm upset by here. How to divide this up? There are so many things.
I think you can divide it up in the. I know that your major beef, okay, and understand the. I understand it is this whole notion of the fact that, you know, we're going basically to war without declaring war.
Let me talk about that for a little bit. You know, first of all, you know, and if you go back and look at the comments on the post I made about this on Saturday, there's actually a decent amount of back and forth on that. And in fact, that's what I was doing right before I started the show. But look, in terms of whether or not the president is quote unquote required to go to Congress. Whether or not you think they initially were under the plain text of the Constitution in terms of, look, these are acts of war. We are imposing, we're doing blockades. We are bombing things. There is no question these are acts of war. And an argument could be made that if you were going to engage in acts of war, that Congress needs to make a declaration of war, especially if it's not, strictly speaking, defensive when somebody attacks us and we defend, where there might not be time to get a congressional declaration of war. However, from the very first days of the Republic, in the era of George Washington, presidents have argued that there is a certain range of actions that they can take without getting Congress involved. And that range of options has grown over the decades and centuries, and even with the 1973 War Powers Act, which put sort of some structure on that, you still have the fundamental case being that with the War Powers Act, there's arguments on both sides. One, that, you know, the act is potentially unconstitutional because the Congress is giving up its prerogatives to the president. And then from the other side, you've got an argument that, you know, it's constraining the president too much, you know, by requiring that they still get authorization from Congress under certain circumstances. But regardless, the precedents that have been set are that whenever the president has done this kind of thing in the past, they've never been slapped for it. You know, the Congress has not had a strong will to defend its own prerogative to be the deciding branch of government in war issues. Despite, you know, the, you know, Congress has the exclusive right to declare war thing, Congress has not shown any appetite to actually be involved in that, and sort of only do it reluctantly when they have to and they've got complete political cover. I mean, as everyone knows, I think the last time the Congress actually declared war was after Pearl Harbor, you know, for World War II.
Correct.
So, you know, but there has been a tradition in more recent decades of Congress providing authorization. And the presidents have always, presidents of both parties have always said, we don't need this. I want to be absolutely clear, we don't need this, but we would like to have, you know, congressional approval for our actions. So from a precedent's point of view, I think it's fairly clear that the president probably can and has and will get away with doing this level of military action without Congress having done jack shit, let alone a formal declaration of war, which hasn't happened in 70 years, or whatever the right math is there. but that there's also the question of the wisdom of what's going on and how to do it. And this is where I actually want to bring up the Powell Doctrine, which I think was a good articulation of things. But let's take a break first, and then we'll jump in right into that. So we'll be back after this message, and I'll rant a little bit about the Powell Doctrine. Okay, so we're back. I wanted to mention the Powell Doctrine because it's something that was articulated during the first Gulf War by General Colin Powell. And it seemed to be sort of a very solid set of guidelines that sort of articulate when it's wise for the U.S. government to get involved in a military action. And it sort of did a lot to sort of undo the ghosts of Vietnam, as it were. It sort of is all like, almost all of it could be almost looked at as how to avoid getting into another Vietnam.
Yes, but in 10 easy steps.
In 8 easy steps, to be precise. But of course, it was subsequently ignored in the second Gulf War and, you know, other stuff and clearly in this situation. But I just wanted to point it out because I think they're actually a good set of guidelines. And I'm looking at Wikipedia. It is based in large part on the Weinberger Doctrine by Caspar Weinberger, who was Colin Powell's old boss. But anyway, here's the list of questions that should have to be answered affirmatively before military action is taken. Number one, is a vital national security interest threatened? Okay, let's talk about Libya.
Well,
no, I don't think it is.
Oil?
Libya has oil,
but prices have been spiking through $100 a barrel.
Prices,
you know, because of the crisis in Libya.
Okay, Libya does have oil, you could make an argument, but it's not like it's the biggest oil producer around.
But it's significant.
It is significant.
And prices in Libya has caused prices. I mean, I don't know about you. I've been noticing it at the pump.
Yeah.
I mean, big time.
Okay.
And I will tell you that you could make an argument that
you
that
could make
could
that argument. I would say it's. I mean, that, I would say it's arguable, but you could recession. Make that argument. Yes. Yes.
You could make an argument that you know you're about you know you're a couple of like continuing fighting over there throwing this frickin' country in another recession because of spiking oil.
Okay, point number two, do we have a clear attainable objective?
No.
So now this is one of the things here. I mean, according to the UN resolution, it's basically, you know, Gaddafi can't fly his planes anymore. He has to back off.
At least I haven't heard anybody articulate one.
You know, the UN resolution actually does have some things it says. He has to stop flying planes. He has to back off from the cities in rebellion. And he has to stop attacking civilians.
Okay, if the purpose, I guess, is stop the civilian attacks...
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, I think that's what the UN resolution says, but now let's take the potential. Let's say we are completely successful at the results of that. What do we end up with? Gaddafi on one side of the country, the rebels on the other side of the country, you know, staring at each other. Are we happy with that outcome? Are we just going to say, okay, we're all good now, bye? I don't know.
I don't know.
I feel reluctant to say that, yes, we will, but on the other hand... You know, George H.W. Bush stopped at the border of Kuwait. He didn't go to Baghdad. You know, so it certainly is possible to have that kind of restraint and say, you know, because there will be people saying, let's go after Gaddafi. Let's go after Gaddafi. And we could say, you know, no, we were authorized only to stop the violence, you know, and stop there. And so I guess there is a clear objective. It's just I'm not sure how much I believe that objective and believe that there won't be mission creep to make it a larger objective.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. That's number two.
Number three, have the risks and costs been fully and frankly analyzed? Certainly not publicly. I mean...
Certainly not publicly. And I know that there's been a lot of debate internally about this whole thing, but yes, I will agree that certainly not publicly.
Yeah. And so... I would damn well hope that there have been good conversations about the risks and costs here. Not just in terms of lives that may be lost directly, because, I mean, you know, right up front, when you look at something like this, there is a good chance that there will be injuries and deaths among the coalition that are trying to enforce this. There is a near certainty that we will accidentally kill some people who didn't deserve it from civilians and children and the like. It always happens. You know, it's almost unavoidable when you start throwing around big explosives. There may be all sorts of other unintended consequences here too. So I don't know. I certainly hope they've been discussed internally. There certainly has not been a vigorous public debate. There just hasn't been time. I mean, we've gone from this whole situation is only a few weeks old, and what our involvement was actually going to be is probably only It's been less than a week since the resolution was passed, and not that much longer that it was being discussed. So I don't think we qualify on this one. And okay. I know we don't qualify on the next one. Have all other nonviolent policy means been fully exhausted?
Well, I disagree on that one. I think probably yes. I mean, let's face it. We sat there. We did resolutions. We sent messages. We did some diplomacy. And let's face it, Gaddafi, declare a cease war, declare a ceasefire, and then basically lie.
Then
fucking pound the bejesus out of them.
Let's do the comparison to how many warnings and how many resolutions there were passed on Iraq before we actually went in there, either the first or second time.
But Iraq was a very different thing. I mean, Saddam... wasn't in the middle of a civil war against his own people, which, you know, he was just bombarding the bejesus out of his own people in the middle of it. I think you could certainly make
an argument. There's another sort of policy thought process called responsibility to protect that's also out there, which is basically, you know, a bunch of countries sort of said after Rwanda and a couple other situations like that, that, you know, if there were... you know, massive internal things like that going on, if there were potential genocides happening, if people were, then other governments have a responsibility to intervene anyway. I think there's some difficulties with that argument, and we'll talk about it in a minute. But okay, so let me potentially give you a partial on nonviolent policy means being exhausted.
Okay.
You know, I think they did try a few things. I don't know whether they... you know, tried the full extent that they could, but I think there's also, you're right, there is also the issue where they felt there was time pressure here.
Yes.
Gaddafi was on the verge of taking back the entire country from the rebels here, at which point...
Or even if he didn't take it over, at least he was going to, you know, he was going to extract one hell of a pound of flesh out of them.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that.
And so there was definitely the feeling here that, you know, if we waited another week, it would be too late. Why bother anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, point number five of the Powell Doctrine. Is there a plausible exit strategy to avoid endless entanglement? What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, we're not committing to any ground troops. I don't think there's a clear answer.
I mean, the question here is all about, and this goes back to the, you know, is there a clear obtainable objective? If
the objective is just to keep him on, you know, on his side of the country and the other side of the country, we keep it for these guys, maybe.
Well, no, but here's the thing. If that is the objective, how is there an end point? Because the second you remove yourself...
Have to wind up with a freaking DMZ zone that we'll have to man for, you know...
Right. If the objective is basically sort of keep the two sides apart, then there's no way to leave while those two sides are still present. So we'd be there until Gaddafi dies on his own, and until his kids die, and until these two sides decide to get along peacefully. And you know how well that works out with the Israelis and Palestinians, or with North and South Korea. You know, look, that could be a long, long time if you're just...
Yep.
If you're just saying, okay, both of you stay on your side of the fence and don't fight.
Yeah, I mean, how many years have we been separating North and South Korea? How long has it been now? What, 60 years?
Since the 50s, so yeah.
Yeah, 60 years, yeah.
So I don't think that's a plausible exit strategy. On the other hand, if your exit strategy depends on getting rid of Gaddafi, well, then your clear obtainable objective just grew quite a bit. I guess it's still a clear obtainable objective, but now it's also no longer supported by the existing UN resolutions. So,
correct.
You know, so what's really going on here? There's a lot of possibility here for mission creep, for, okay, now we've got everybody on their side of the fence, but, you know, now what? You know, we can't just go home. We have to keep something in place indefinitely unless we change something else, which leads us to a greater involvement. So I don't know that the exit strategy is well defined here. I certainly don't hear about an exit strategy. I mean, you hear like Obama saying things like our involvement is going to be in the order of days and not weeks. And you know, that potentially applies if we really stick to, okay, we'll take out their air defenses and then the rest of the coalition is doing everything else. And if that actually happens, maybe this, I don't know, but you know, I guess a lot rides on, is there really a willpower to keep this limited? And I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know.
Number six.
I don't know.
Have the consequences of our action been fully considered? Again, this is certainly not publicly.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like we're getting ourselves involved with a situation we don't fully understand. You know, I still haven't heard a lot publicly. And again, maybe there's a lot of private knowledge going on, but it certainly hasn't been well discussed in public in terms of, okay, are we really getting inside... We're getting involved in a civil war in the side of the anti-Gaddafi people who we don't really completely understand exactly who they are and what they want and what they would do if they got power.
Yeah, because we have no idea whether these guys hate us too. I mean, and I'm like, I mean, that's the one thing I think we mentioned this last week. I'm like, you know, in most of these freaking conflicts, honestly, all of these people fucking hate our guts anyway. I mean, so I'm not sure. I mean, we certainly can't be doing this because we're thinking that we're gonna install a regime that likes us. I mean, the best case scenario that we're just doing it to stop a mass slaughter of civilians by Gaddafi. that's about the best thing you can say about this.
And you know, and like I said, we'll talk about this in a second. That's not necessarily a bad goal, but the problem is extending that. Like, if we do it here, where else should we be doing it? But anyway, so moving on, is the action supported by the American people? And this is one
on that count. As far as I can tell, the answer is no.
Yes, and this is also where the whole congressional thing comes into play, where, you know, the process of going to the Congress and making a case and having them, you know, approve it is one of the steps. It's not sufficient in and of itself, but it's one of the steps in terms of building a broad public support. And, you know, this is one of the things where, you know, I would not have fully expected this to be done in this way by Obama, but like George W. Bush for Iraq spent months, you know, building his case and getting people on board. And, you know, you can argue all you want now that some of it was based on bad intelligence or even that he might have known some of that and lied. Although he denies that to this day, he says he was duped too, but you know, he made the effort. He went through the process. Certainly George H.W. Bush did. I think Clinton did in some of his engagements too, although maybe a little less so.
But it depends. I mean, it depends. I mean, think about when we went to Somalia, for example, under George H.W. He didn't go out and campaign for support.
He did some, but certainly not the big effort.
Right. Well, we went to Bosnia. First Libyan attack that Reagan did, a grenade. I don't know. Hey, that's been inconsistent over the years.
You know, I think it has. And one of the patterns, which we may see continued here, is that, you know, there's been less effort on those lines for the smaller ones, that it was perceived would be over quickly and easily. And I think that's the perception here, is really that this is going to be a short-term pop. We're going to do this. We'll be out, and then, you know, we won't have to worry about it anymore. And if that if this ends up being, you know, the equivalent of Grenada, or, you know, one of these other small or Panama even, which, you know, were relatively small scale. I mean, I don't want to diminish there were people killed. There was a lot that happened. It was a significant international action. But
Panama, I mean, fuck, we fucking invaded the country, for Christ's sakes. I mean, let's face it.
But, I mean, in comparison to Iraq or Afghanistan, they were small scale efforts.
Correct.
And I think that's the perception here, is that, you know, this isn't going to be a significant enough action that it requires the president going out and spending, you know, a month making sure the public is on board. But on the other hand, as sort of even with those smaller scale actions, I think that there was a degree of public support that was, you know, built up a little bit more. I mean, like you mentioned the initial attack on Libya in the 80s. I mean, whether or not there was buildup of support for that specific attack, we'd been demonizing Gaddafi for forever.
Yeah, we had Gaddafi that's true. That's correct. Yeah.
Everybody, the general public already had in their mental awareness that, hey, here's a bad guy, you know, and he's doing something bad. Let's do something about it. Even with Panama, we'd been talking about how Noriega was a bad guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, Noriega, yeah, that's true. True.
You know, these things were going on, but I think here it is just sort of, Obama gave like one brief speech, and then after the attack started, he gave it like two sentences in the middle of a conversation he was doing on Brazilian trade, and then let Hillary speak about the rest. I mean, this doesn't seem commensurate with, hey, we're engaging in a significant military action. And maybe, again, the idea is that it's not a significant military action, it's just some military action. I don't know. I mean, and you know, right now our involvement is cruise missiles, and you know, Clinton certainly lobbed off. I mean, Clinton threw missiles at the Sudan, right? At one point,
missiles at the Sudan. We kept throwing missiles at where Bin Laden was hiding up in the Sudan. He was hiding also up north in in Pakistan or wherever the hell. No,
our attack on the Sudan was because we thought he was there. He wasn't, but anyway.
Right. No, no, no. Yeah, but I thought we did, but what we, I mean, I know we did Sudan, but we also did, yeah, he moved around and we did it a couple of different places and stuff. And so, I don't know. So we certainly have done that a number of times.
There's certainly plenty of precedents for presidents doing stuff. And I'm not necessarily arguing, you know, although I go back fundamentally to that we shouldn't be doing any of this shit without declarations of war, formal declarations of war, but I know that's like a lost cause. But at the very least, I argue for the wisdom of it. Is it wise for a president to go in and get involved in a significant manner with our military forces someplace where...
We have liftoff.
Where the public is not educated and informed and... engaged and agrees that it's a good idea, you know, and you're never going to get universal agreement, of course, but at least like, you know, I don't know. It seems like it's like almost an off the cuff. Oh yeah. We're going to attack Libya on Tuesday, you know,
after breakfast. Yeah. Libya. Well, what the hell, you know, launch Tomahawks.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, just anyway. To finish it off, number 8 on the Powell Doctrine. Do we have genuine broad international support? I'll give him this one. Yeah, yeah, it certainly seems like we do.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, we definitely do.
So the bottom line on all of those together is that, excuse me, I think we have a very mixed picture here. There's a lot of uncertainty about this engagement and where it'll end up, and certainly uncertainty in the communication to the public. Maybe internally to the Obama administration, they know exactly what they're doing and what the limits of this will be and when they will stop and what they will stop for. But that's certainly not something that there's a lot of public awareness of and public support for at this point. We'll see. I do want to talk a little bit about this responsibility to protect thing, and that'll be in the context of some of the other countries that have stuff going on. But it's time for another break. It's way past time for another break.
We have liftoff.
What's liftoff this time?
The 747-8 first flight liftoff.
Oh, okay. I should look out the window.
It's up. Yeah. It's up.
Okay. We'll be back after your poem of the week.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by Notel Motel.
The History of the Hat, Part 1, by Lily Ladewig. But what comfort is there in a hat? Historically, a knight's helmet was trimmed with a feather, which was a gift from his wife or girlfriend, the red of it popping out against the gray. It's about seeing yourself out there in the world, knowing you tuck into someone's brim like an ice cube in a tray.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
Okay. Responsibility to protect. So this is another thing. And, you know, I'm bringing up the Wikipedia page to know what I'm talking about, too. It's often abbreviated as R2P, which sounds like insane and stupid. But it's not
R2D2. No.
It's basically a set of principles that has evolved over the last few years. And like I said, a lot of this was in response to the genocide in Rwanda from a while back. But basically, it's the idea that national sovereignty is a responsibility, not a privilege. It focuses on preventing and halting genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. It's thought of as having 3 points: that a state has a responsibility to protect its own population from those things. If the state is unable to protect the population on its own, the international community has a responsibility to assist by building its capacity. And then finally, if a state is manifestly failing to protect its citizens from those things, the international community has the responsibility to intervene at first diplomatically, then more coercively, then as a last resort with military force. So the idea is if you see a country going and like doing mass slaughters of civilians, the international community has an obligation to do something about it and not just sort of sit and say tisk tisk. That's the bottom line to this thing. Now, And you know, and a lot of governments have sort of said, yeah, that's a good idea. But when push comes to shove, and it's an entirely different thing. Like, we could say that, you know, okay, that's what's going on here in Libya. But then the problem with that is, then why Libya?
Because of the scale of it, I guess?
It's not even scale. I mean, like, if you tried to provide a uniform standard for this across the world, there'd probably be a half a dozen places that were requiring our intervention at this point.
Which other places right now that we're not focusing on is the country's own military basically bombarding a city in order to fucking pound them into submission?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you're right that if you provide that level of standard here, then, you know...
I mean, not even in Egypt, when the protesters were, not even in Bahrain.
Well, they're not shelling people in Bahrain, but they have certainly been shooting people.
No, sure, they have been. But I'm like, we're not talking about a mass shelling of an entire city. Even like, you know, let's face it, in Benghazi, you could be sitting in your house not doing anything. You'd still probably wind up dead.
I don't know. I'm not sure I entirely buy it. There's so many. The problem with this is we're so selective.
I'm with you. I will say that I do believe that the scale of this, if I compare it to any of the other things that have happened over the last several months, certainly quite an order of magnitude significantly, more aggressive.
How about Darfur? I mean, that's sort of quieted down lately, but certainly a couple years ago, wouldn't it have qualified?
Well, I'm talking about now. I don't know.
Well, this is my point. Like, things.
But this is why I know it's a slippery slope.
If exactly what was happening right now, instead of happening in Libya, was happening in. Let's do a couple scenarios. One would be like some random country in sub-Saharan Africa that we never hear about in the news. The other would be, what if it was happening in one of the former Soviet states?
Let me ask a question. You know,
would treat them entirely differently.
I guess it comes also to the level of attention that its neighbors and that it's and the people pay attention to it. You know, let's face it. I can't remember what the hell's the African Nation Coalition bullshit thing. You know, like the Arab League thing. I can't remember the fucking name.
There are several organizations you might be talking about, but go ahead.
Well, think about this. Like, none of them went and passed a resolution like the one that the Arab League passed in order to ask for support. They didn't go to the UN and fucking went to the Security Council and fucking push for all this shit. And so I guess, like, with everything, you know, it's the level of attention that its neighbors and everybody pay to it, you know?
Well, right. It's like this squeaky wheel getting the grease, or it's like are there cameras? Are there people tweeting on the internet? A country we've heard of before? None of these are standards that are rational standards.
No,
you know.
I mean, let's face it. I guess if I go what happened in Iran last?
Well, there you go. I mean, here's the thing. Like, if we are going to...
The Arab League didn't go and condemn Iran. Why the hell did the Arab League go and condemn Gaddafi, but yet they didn't condemn Iran?
Because they didn't like him anyway. You know, like, I look at this kind of thing and say, look, if you're going to really make an argument that we need to intervene in areas where the government are doing bad things to their people, and you're right, there may be a question of scale here. We look at that. But, like, you know... Bahrain and Yemen have been doing bad things over the last few weeks to repress the demonstrations there, including shooting and killing innocent people who are doing nothing more than peaceful demonstration. But both of those countries have been helping us out, have been our friends. Yep. Saudi Arabia is awful to its own people. You know, you don't see us saying a damn thing about Saudi Arabia. Iran... obviously what happened last year, but you know, hey, it's big. It would be, you know, it would be worse than Iraq to try to do get involved there, you know, et cetera. You know, and of course they, like you said, they weren't asking, but, and wouldn't, but, you know, it just seems like the bottom line I have on this thing is like, look, yes, it might be a better thing if Gaddafi was gone, just like it would might have been a better thing with Saddam Hussein gone. But is there a direct interest at stake here where this is going to make a big difference to us, where it is worth us getting deeply involved? And I guess the question is also the argument about deeply. If Obama sticks to, hey, we lobbed a few missiles in and we're done, maybe it's not really all that deeply, and maybe, you know, in the end, you know, okay, things turned out okay. You know, I have no doubt that if our military is given the mission either of just stopping things like they have been done now or getting rid of Gaddafi, they probably could achieve that. The question is, you know, what are the unintended consequences going to be, and what is the cost going to be over time? And, you know, are we really going to be able to get in and get out, or is this going to be a long-term commitment? At the same time, we've got long-term commitments going on other places. And, you know, I just, you know, maybe it'll all turn out perfectly and everybody will be happy in a few weeks, but I deeply worry about accidentally falling into a deep pit here. And maybe Obama will be able to avoid it. Maybe I'm not giving him enough credit here, but you're getting us, it's a dangerous situation that has a lot of potential for going sideways the wrong way.
Well, we'll see where we go. We've already burned up how much time on this? My God.
Yeah, okay.
I think we've burned up Libya to oblivion. We'll know next week how it's going. Okay,
right. Okay, let's take a break, and we'll whiz through several other issues in a final segment, and then we'll be done. And this will be a relatively long show. Sorry, guys. Okay, we'll be back after this. Okay, we are back. We've got, we sort of touched on other countries. Bahrain's blowing up, Yemen's blowing up, things, blah, blah, blah.
So let's talk about Japan, okay, for a little bit. All right, here's one thing that, a couple of things.
I just want to start with this. You know, if you're on the west coast of the United States, don't believe all the shit you keep seeing in emails people forward to you or things on Facebook.
You were going to say that you already bought your radiation suit.
Yeah, I've bought my radiation suit. I'm taking iodine. I'm hiding in the basement. No, look. There's nothing to worry about. Like, there in some places on the West Coast, there may be radiation levels that are slightly elevated that are barely detectable by really good instruments. The amount of elevated radiation is less than what you get by going outside and trying to get a suntan. You know, it's, you know, even the people like who were like in Japan, but not in the immediate vicinity. Like the radiation levels.
Like in Tokyo!
Like the radiation levels they've detected in Tokyo, which have been elevated on a couple of occasions. The equivalent is like taking a plane flight. You get that much radiation from that. Yeah, look, it could get worse. There could be bad things happening. But even in the worst possible scenario that could happen here, the West Coast of the United States does not need to worry. You know,
or Hawaii
or Alaska, but so people are getting really paranoid about stuff. That's not to say, you know, if you're one of the workers trying to put out fires and put water and coolant into this site, that you are not at a significant health risk. If you
which brings to me. The one subject that I noticed about, which is something that I've been thinking about all week. Why the fuck the Japanese, which have been robot crazy, I mean, you've seen, like, where remember are all the robots? And all the, where the fuck are robots?
I did see an article within the last 24 hours saying that they were bringing in some robots.
Yes! You know where from?
Where?
Us! iRobot is sending them. There's a Roomba. They're sending robots over. They're sending the ones that we use for our military, the whatchamacallit, the robot? No. In their desperation, Japanese authorities have turned to Massachusetts-based iRobot for help. The Special Ops Division of Japan apparently asked for assistance from the U.S. military contractor, and four robots were en route to Japan Friday, okay? It's the Pack Robots and Warriors, which can be operated from over 2,000 feet away and could be used in tasks like hauling hoses to help fight fires. And I'm like, wait, what? They have to, I gotta admit, I am absolutely shocked from the country that gave us the IBO that they don't have a robot like this.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Honda have that Asimo robot? And fuck, I've seen all these damn robots. They did. I guess none of them can do anything real, I guess.
Yes.
Practical?
So.
Okay. So that's one thing. No robots.
They should just send in an army of IBOs.
Yes, that would be interesting. But of course, all they'll probably do is just, like, I don't know, play with a hose and fetch or something.
I was interested in that too. I mean, there's so many robots available for so many things. It is somewhat surprising that the effort to contain this wasn't like 99% robots. But
yeah,
I mean, there's something I'm you like, still need the humans for. But still,
but for what? I mean, we've built cars. I mean, for Christ's sakes, we got cars that drive themselves. I mean, you could probably jury rig relatively quickly a fire truck to drive itself instead of having to put somebody in it. I mean, how long would it take? I mean, really? Fucking make the truck, remote guide the truck, fucking aim, make the fucking hose aim and shoot it. I mean, how long could that take? Honestly, if you put a couple of smart guys on top of it, you'd probably get it done in 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently we're sending the stuff over to get it done, which is just interesting. But so the other news, apparently they're finally getting power to the reactors, and they're finally getting. I know that GE was shipping some turbines from the U.S. in order to get them enough. Which that's another part I don't understand. Fucking portable generator. This is like baffling. But anyway, this is a fucking major league. Electric company, and they don't have portable generators.
The bottom line on the situation there was that it seemed to be at its worst. They're finally getting it under control. Right. I just wanted to make a note. I should have at the beginning here on the radiation dose stuff. There's a good chart that was put out by Randall Monroe, who does the XKCD cartoon, which is like a geeky cartoon. Very good. I recommend it to everybody. He, along with a friend of his who, you know, works with a nuclear reactor somewhere, put together a radiation dose chart. You can get to it by xkcd.com/radiation. Anyway, it puts a lot of these things, in context. So, for instance, the radiation from a one-day dose at one of the two sites in Fukushima on March 16th, which was one of the high days, gives you just slightly more radiation than a mammogram would give you. And it's actually still less than the normal yearly background dose.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, it's like putting all of these things in production in context. And
where is the thing?
xkcd.com/radiation. Yeah, so here's another one that's just to keep in mind. Living within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant for a year, operating properly, of course, gives you about the same amount of radiation as you get from eating a banana. Which bananas are radioactive, by the way, because they contain potassium, and potassium has a radioactive isotope that sometimes gives off radiation. Well, so
I should be dead.
Anyway, interesting stuff to look at. I think the whole... It certainly had the potential to get worse. It has a lot of potential negative stuff in the area very close to the reactor. But the way that people have been panicking, you know, all across the world, let alone across Japan, is way overblown to the actual risks here. And so, I don't know. People need to get a grip. In the end, this whole radiation event, even if it went worst case, would still be eclipsed by the number of people who were killed by the tsunami. And so let's keep our perspective on the right thing here. Are you eating a banana?
All right. No, I had my wife coming over and saying hi to me. So, and my dog.
Okay, radiation. Okay, anything else in Japan?
Nah, not particularly. I think, other than, if you've seen the news, factories, and they're still conserving power, they're still search and rescue, it's going to be one heck of a long recovery, but, I think that if they can get this nuclear situation under control this week, and people just focus on the rescue efforts, they certainly have got as many resources as you can put into it as possible. It's the best that anybody can do. It's just an awful situation, but certainly recoverable over the long term. You can't recover from death, obviously, but for the rest of the population, I think the one thing that they showed a little bit, northern Japan is significantly poorer than southern Japan, certainly not the industrial part of the country, and to some people, it's been a little bit like a lot of the people living there were retirees, or there were people close to retirement. There were an older age, and some of them have been like, "What the hell am I going to rebuild? I was 75 years old. There was this guy that were interviewing. I had a barber shop. Now it's gone. My house is gone. I'm like, seriously, I'm going to spend all my money right now on rebuilding this business that's gone. I'm like,
put back a barbershop. There's nobody there to get their haircut anyway.
So there's a lot of despair in that sense, especially for the people that were of an older age. And the area certainly had a higher proportion of retirees and elderly people. Japan's demographics have been moving that way over the last 40 years, but this area was even worse than the average. So, it's, we'll see what happens, but certainly there's a lot of people that are, trying to recover, and it's going to be a long road, so.
Okay, you want to still do New York Times paywall, or do you want to call it a show?
Oh, no, let's talk about that damn thing, because it's insane.
Okay, so the New York Times this week put out an announcement saying that when's it start? End of this month? Sometime soon, right?
I believe it's the end of the month. I was actually going to pull up the announcement right now because I actually had something here. Where the heck did it go?
Anyway, New York Times is going to try again with a paywall. They've made several attempts to put various things behind paywalls in the past. And basically, you know, people are going to get a certain number of articles for free, but then if they want to read more than that, they have to pony up money. What money and what plan depends on how they want to read their stuff, whether it's on a phone, a tablet, the web, you know, and there are also going to be exemptions. Like if you come through a search engine, you get more free articles. If you get linked from a blog, that's going to be free.
Well, apparently it doesn't count against your 20 article read count if you came through a search engine. That's what I read on it. But
I think there was still a limit. There was still a limit for like Google. Like you could do more for Google, but it wasn't infinite.
But the fees are exorbitant.
And it would be free from like if you're referred through Twitter or blogs and such. And of course, so somebody immediately put up a Twitter feed that just does every New York Times article. Go ahead.
But it's like, I mean, they want to charge somewhere close to $500 a year for the fucking New York Times.
Well, that number is if you got all of the different things. So if you had...
Well, still anyway, I'm like...
Well, here's one of the interesting things. Like, they're trying to break it up. Like, you've got one subscription if you want to read on the web, another one if you want to read on your phone, another one if you want to read on tablets.
But why the fuck would you have... I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, that just boggles the mind. Why the fuck if I mean, it's like telling me if I want to read my magazine in the toilet or if I want to read it in the fucking while I'm sitting in the kitchen, well, there's a different fee. Well, you're reading it from the toilet. You're going to be reading it more intently. So therefore, we need to charge you $20 extra. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like, and here's the other thing that I find about this, okay? While I like the content from the New York Times, don't get me wrong. I mean, I read it all the time. I mean, it's not that unique that it deserves such an enormous premium. I mean, they're charging more. This is more expensive than a Wall Street Journal pay plan. Okay? Yeah. Far more expensive. Which is why I'm like, I'm sorry, you just went from not charging anybody for the longest time to going, and by the way, you have another, there's only one really other real like pay company on the web, which is for news, which is the Wall Street Journal, and you decide to go in and charge more. Okay? And
And the London Times is charging now too, right?
Is it?
Yeah, I believe so. Okay. Rupert Murdoch is put up a paywall there. I don't know how much it is.
Oh, okay.
They haven't given lots of information on how that's been going for them, but from what I gather, they're collecting some money, but it's, you know, their readership has plummeted. Their online readership has plummeted, which is what you expect, frankly. When you put up a paywall, you expect that a lot fewer people will read your stuff. It's only going to be that subset who really thinks it's valuable enough to pay for. Do you make enough money to make it worth it?
Well, I just went into the Sunday Times, and I just got in, and hold on. Let me see if I – well, it's let me in, but it's not asking me to do anything. So
they probably only put some things behind the paywall. Anyway.
Okay, because that's what the Wall Street Journal is doing also right now. The Wall Street Journal went from being completely behind a paywall to actually having a mixed – you can go to the Wall Street Journal and there is free content. Oh, there it is. Okay. Welcome to the Times and Sunday Times websites, available exclusively by subscription. Access from only £1. Okay. Yep. Yeah, it is. There it is.
Anyway, look, the bottom line on all of these things, I'm going to do my usual broken record thing here. The pay model here will end up working only for people who have extremely compelling content that is very unique from other content that you can get elsewhere on the web, and you've got a core group of people who really need that information and are willing to pay for it. It may well work for it clearly does work for the Wall Street Journal. It may work for general news if the quality of that general news is so far above and beyond everything else, and news junkies really, really want to make sure they have it. you're not going to get, you know, billions of people reading, though. You're going to get that core group of news junkies who's willing to pay for it. It's probably never going to work for, you know, celebrity gossip and things like that that are very easily reproduced and tossed around, you know.
But it's just a, I mean, I will agree, but the, also, let's face it, the pricing has to be reasonable. I mean, I'm looking at this freaking thing, and I'm like, let me see which one's the cheapest. It's $35 a month, for Christ's sakes. For readers who just want limited access from via the Times tablet app, the cost is $20 every 4 weeks. To access the paper through a smartphone, I mean, through a smartphone, for heaven's sakes, is $15 a week. I mean, no, 4 weeks. So that's $15, and it's not even, like, monthly. It's, like, four fucking weeks. I mean, this is the one thing. It's, like, the fucking fees are, like, broken out in some wacko way. I mean, I'm like, who the fuck sat down and figured this thing out?
I'll tell you, like, I am not a big New York Times reader. I haven't been in a long, long time. I don't find it convenient. I recently installed a little browser bar thing that shows me like the top six stories from the Times, and every once in a while I'll click on them. But you know, if I clicked on them and I ever once got like a sorry dude, you got to pay for this, I'm uninstalling that bar and never looking at it again.
Yeah, well, let me put it, the cheapest plan, by the way, is $195 a year. Okay. Yeah.
Look, I know the New York Times is desperate. They need to figure out a way to make some money in order to stay in business. But I'm sorry, you know, the bottom line might be bye-bye New York Times. You know,
well, with this fucking plan, yeah.
I mean, because look, one of the things here is fundamentally, given that you've now got a model that's, you know, people have shown that they somewhat tolerate advertising on the web. People have not shown a high tolerance for subscriptions, other than those unique circumstances I outlined before. And when they do, it's for much smaller amounts of money and less people. There are a lot less people who will pay $15 a month for the New York Times than will throw a few quarters down to pick one up at the newsstand. You know? And so as this gets converted, you know, there's the bottom line might be there's less money to be made, which means you can't support a really large organization, which means you have to figure out how to, if you want to continue to make money at it, you have to figure out how to be a much smaller, leaner organization, you know, and all of these big traditional newspapers. I mean, we're not just talking about a few reporters on the payroll. We're talking about, you know, layers of management. We're talking about huge advertising staffs. We've talking about, you know, they're big organizations, and it may well be that the economics of the web and mobile devices can't support those big, huge organizations anymore.
Well, let me put it to you this way. The New York Times, I read one thing that their advertising on NewYorkTimes.com earns $100 million a year in revenue. Okay. Now, I do understand that maybe compared to the print advertising that they get right now, it's probably significantly less. But, you know, let me see. Digital advertising, let's see, for one quarter. Actually, the New York Times Company, out of $2 billion in revenues, they are generating digital advertising revenues of about... Well, fourth quarter total year increased 11%, 113 million. News Media Group to 166. So about $111 million a quarter. So that adds up to about $400 million a year in that kind of advertising. I mean, honestly, I would have thought, you know, that if you focused on figuring out ways to make more monetizing that, I mean, I figured that you'd get to a much better level. I just don't think they really thought this thoroughly enough. That's what I'm thinking. I think this is just some knee jerk reaction right now that is just ridiculous.
I don't know that it's an issue of really thinking it through. I think it's an issue of being desperate. They want to figure out something that'll work, and they really don't know how. And what they were
But the fucking problem is that they should have figured this out 10 years ago.
Well, yes.
These fucking companies went and, like, you know, 13 years ago, fucking stuck their head in the sand, and I don't know what the fuck they were expecting, and now all of a sudden, at the last minute, now they're trying to figure out how to fucking unfuck themselves, okay? They should have never given away their content in the first place, which is the problem. It's like, how the fuck you turn people around when you start giving shit away for free? And that was the biggest problem. It's like, imagine if cable TV would have come out for free, and then 10 years later, oh, well, we want to charge you $50 a month to watch TV.
You know, honestly, I think that would only be a stopgap anyway. Like, if they hadn't given their stuff away for free, they'd be in the same situation as the music and movie industries, which is it's incredibly easy to get it for free anyway, because all it takes is one person taking that day's newspaper and downloading it and making it available elsewhere for free. And so, you know, but
you see, here's the thing, but on the counterpoint, what iTunes also proved was that if you actually came up with an honest pay model that was reasonably priced, that people could get easy access to it, people would gravitate first towards that than the other model. But that's not what they did either.
Absolutely, and I think that would happen. But you still see the music industry griping about iTunes because they make a lot less than they used to. And I think would be true.
Hey, life changes, you know? Fucking, you know, get used to it. Okay? So anyway, all right.
And that's
We've
a
pounded
show.
Everything.
Life changes, get used to it. Okay.
All right.
I just want one sentence additional thing on Libya. On Afghanistan and Iraq, Obama could say, you know, I'm cleaning up the mess that other people left me. On
and
Libya, Libya, this is
it's
all him.
Yours.
This is Obama's
it's
war. He owns it. If it goes well, if it goes badly, and you know, I hope it goes well. I hope it goes well. I'm just worried that it won't. But and maybe I'm just a worry wart and I should, you know, cut it out and don't worry, be happy. But, you know, anyway, that's a show. Thanks, everybody, for joining us
that's
on this week's Curmudgeon's Corner. Email me, abelsmay@abelsmay.com. Questions, comments, thoughts. We always like those. Tell your friends to listen. We like listeners. And even though I lost those stats on the last couple weeks of December, and I'm really bummed about that, I'm going to catch up on and figure out how many people are actually listening these days. Based on what I was seeing at the beginning of December, it's more than I thought it was. But we'll see. Maybe all those people disappeared between now and then. Or then and now, or something. Anyway. Goodbye, everyone. Goodbye. Goodbye. Say goodbye, Yvonne.
Bye-bye.
Later, folks. Thanks, Yvonne. Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.